This podcast contains information, theories, and speculation based on the A Song of Ice and Fire novels by George R.R. Martin. It can and will spoil future episodes of the HBO television series Game of Thrones. This is your one and only spoiler warning. If you're looking for our non-spoiler podcast on Game of Thrones, please look in our feed archives for our Sunday night instant take and Tuesday afternoon full podcasts, or go to baldmove.com for our entire catalog. Hey, welcome to the spoiler edition for the Game of Thrones podcast on Bald Move. This is for episode, I don't even remember.
607. The Broken Man.
It feels
like it's been a long week.
You know, actually, it feels like it's been more than a week.
Yeah.
It really feels, while I was compiling the spoiler edition, I threw on the Game of Thrones because I realized I wasn't even sure what the hell. You know, I feel like I've lived a couple lifetimes since then. First up, since a lot of people ask, my dad's doing great. He came through the surgery fine. He's progressing ahead of schedule. He hasn't quite gotten out of the ICU yet, but I think that feels like more of a formality. He's up and moving about, and he should be home sometime late this weekend, Monday at the latest, assuming there's no further complications. So thanks for everybody for the well wishes. I couldn't get back with everybody who'd sent them in since the Monday podcast, but I did read them all, and I appreciated it. As a follow-on, since I didn't get back until last night and immediately had to do a Penny Dreadful podcast, this is going to be a bit of a shotgun spoiler edition. I didn't have nearly as much time to look into and research, and sometimes people ask me to do things to research, and I'm happy to do it, but I had to punt some of those to next week if they don't get dry-pied by the episode itself, because that happens a lot, too. I tend to save feedback from, you know, I get, you know, Tuesday through the following week, and if it's still relevant, can consider it, but sometimes, you know, events blow things wide open, and what are you going to do? So, enough of the excuses and belly aching out of the way. The one thing I want to talk about before we kind of get to everybody else's stuff is the character of Lym Lemoncloak and Lady Stoneheart, and how it looks like maybe, against all odds, we might actually get the Stoneheart character. Back in 5 wrote in, the more they talk about the Red Wedding, especially I slit your niece's throat, etc. comments, and with the return of the Brotherhood without banners, doesn't Lady Stoneheart almost have to show up at this point? So I want to talk about a couple of these things. There's a new character that was kind of at the forefront of the supposed Brotherhood. And he had a yellow, like a mustard yellow cloak.
Okay.
And he's a big brawny dude with a scruffy beard. And it seems obvious to book readers that this is a character known as Lym Lemoncloak.
That is a terrible name. Like, oh, God. Okay.
So I don't think that's his. I think it's his name is Lym, and people call him Lemoncloak because of his piss yellow coat, cloak.
Okay.
I don't think that's his given name. So he's prominently associated with Lady Stoneheart. He's there. He's actually kind of her executioner for when she hangs a bunch of Freys at one point in one of the books. Hmm. And he's present at the hanging, or the threatened hanging of Podrick Payne and Brienne towards the tail end of where we're at in the books. The other interesting thing about it is, so Sandor, he came back this week, and everybody's, you know, super excited about the you-know-what.
Mm-hmm.
In the books, Sandor, of course, is retrieved by the Septon Maribald on the Quiet Isle, and he's kind of living with these monks. And then if you recall, there was these two savage characters that was with Jack and Hagar when Arya saved them. One guy who had his teeth filed down to points was named appropriately Biter, and the other character was named Rorge. I think is how you pronounce it. And he has distinguished by having a missing nose. Rorge finds the Hound's helm either atop the, you know, pile of stones that was supposed to be the Hound's grave, or just lying discarded, and he starts wearing it in the books. He's part of a remnant of a band called the Brave Companions. Most people call them the Bloody Mummers. And they kind of go raping and reaving around the countryside, and he's wearing the Hound's helmet. And he sacks this town called Salt Pans, and it's an especially brutal sack where they just are really hard on the civilians. And this leads to a popular theory about the Hound still being alive and being kind of a psychotic criminal. Well, the Brotherhood, who are chasing these people down in line with their mission to kind of protect the small folk, find these characters after Brienne has a run-in with them, and she's kills them and leaves their corpses on the ground and leaves the Hound's helmet behind, and Lim Lemoncloak takes the helmet.
Okay.
Now, I'm giving you all this background so you'll appreciate the things I'm about to say next. The interesting thing is there's a couple alternate Clegane Bowl theories. Number one is Lim Lemoncloak. There's a lot of evidence in the books, and I don't have time to kind of process this into an easily digestible format, but I'm going to link you to the popular theories about it. There's a lot of compelling evidence that says this Lim Lemoncloak is actually a former squire for Rhaegar Targaryen.
Hmm. Okay.
And the other interesting thing about him is he was also good friends with Robert Baratheon. And apparently he chose sides during a rebellion and sided with the Targaryens. And why that is interesting is that a lot of people think that he might have some inside information about, you know, Rhaegar and Lyanna's love affair and perhaps the child that a lot of people speculate, you know, to 99.9% certainty is Jon Snow. So there's kind of like an alternate path for where you could get the, that you could get information for who Jon is and whether he's the Princess Promised and whether he's a Targaryen and all that. The other interesting thing about his character is that he's got the Hound's helmet. He's wearing a yellow cloak, which is traditionally associated with the Cleganes. In fact, their coat of arms is essentially a yellow field with three dogs that are kind of like pouncing on it. Hmm. So there's some speculation that since the Hound is at peace and the Hound is kind of lame from the fight, that there's going to be events that transpire that Lim Lemoncloak, who is kind of a warrior and a soldier in his own right, is going to pose as the Hound in the Clegane Bowl and attack, you know, and defeat Gregor Clegane or get killed by Gregor Clegane. No one really knows. Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting symmetry there because you've essentially got the former Mountain, who's resurrected and going by the name of Sir Robert Strong and wearing the Kingsguard armor, is going against a fake version of the Hound, another guy that's actually dressed up in the Hound's armor. So there's those two interesting angles and parallels. I for the book, I think it's fine that he's like some lord or, you know, knight of some import that he might have information. I'm not sure how that would fit into the show. And I also feel like that people would feel like it was a deeply unsatisfying switcheroo if Lim Lemoncloak ends up fighting the Mountain in the Hound's behalf. I do think the interesting thing about Lim Lemoncloak is that he is a closely kind of associated with the new version of Brotherhood without banners under Lady Stoneheart, and we might be seeing Lady Stoneheart herself. The thing that I don't understand is that, you know, even under Lady Stoneheart's management, where they shift focus from protecting the small folk to persecuting the Freys and Boltons, that there is no evidence that she's just running around and completely lost her mind and just killing wantingly everyone. It could be that this is like a Martin's Razor remix of like the Bloody Mummers the Lim Lemoncloak character, and maybe Brienne will run into him and he'll have to duel her. And
This guy's name is Piss Piss Cloak.
Cloak, sure.
It's real, you know, it's a mix.
So there's another more obscure theory that is in play here. And if I could summarize the evidence of this, is that at one point Jaime called Brienne essentially the Hound with teats.
Okay.
And Brienne is a fierce warrior who is not kind of hobbled in any way. And if she runs into this Lim Lemoncloak who's wearing a Hound's helmet, that there could be some kind of confluence of events that would have her don the Hound's armor and fight as the Hound against Gregor.
Okay. That's interesting.
But again, that's just based on a throwaway comment for Jamie and the fact that they're approximately the same size. And
right.
I don't, I, I don't, I don't know what quite to make of all this, and this is where, like, this is where the spoiler podcast, the secret sauce, is. I have 6 to 7 hours to kind of pore over this stuff and assimilate it and kind of package it up, and I just haven't had time to do that.
I think the thing that really struck me about what you said is just how dissatisfying it would be for all the people who want the Clegane Bowl to happen, to have it happen in some way that kind of subverts the basic idea of the Clegane Bowl, of the brothers facing off against each other.
It's like, you're going to give us the Clegane Bowl, which a lot of people thought was unlikely, and then do it in such a way that it's not really the Clegane Bowl.
Yeah, it doesn't feel very satisfying.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Peyton Manning versus Tom Brady, except for under the helmet, it's actually Eli Manning, and I don't know who Tom Brady's brother is. It's his wife, right. Giselle, or whatever the supermodel is. And it's like, surprise! Like, what the hell did I just watch there?
Yeah.
But, so the other thing that's kind of interesting is maybe what they're going for is that Lady Stoneheart is a true adherent of the Lord of Light, and that this is a religious killing, and it's not motivated, like, she's like maybe the show is going to tell a different version of the book truth, which is that, you know, yes, she wants to get the Freys and the Boltons, but also she's become a sincere convertant to the Lord of Light because she got brought back to life by she didn't technically get brought back to life by Thoros of Myr. Beric Dondarrion, like, breathed his life into her and died himself, but you know what I'm saying. So, and there's a lot of interesting things about how, you know, Daenerys is backed by the Lord of the Light. King's Landing is being gripped by religious hysteria of the Faith of the Seven. Jon Snow is doing battle, you know, with these White Walkers who were birthed from the Children of the Forest, who worshipped with the old gods, and his brother might very well be an old god at this point. Like, there's this interesting kind of three-way religious battle royale. But I don't know, because it just, Catelyn Stark as Lady Stoneheart is definitely like this vengeful spirit, but I still the fact that she would just kill innocent people seems very crazy to me.
Yeah, it sounds like her vengeance is focused on
the
particular perpetrators of that crime.
So I don't know if we'll find out that this limb is a fake and there's a real limb and cloak that's going around, and but there'll be some stuff we're going to be talking about here in a minute that kind of deals with this. Also, something that this is not necessarily a spoiler in the strictest sense of the word, it's just extraordinarily forensic analysis of information, that someone took the letter that Sansa took, flipped it upside down, and essentially did the CSI thing where they just enhance, and they were able to decipher 99% of the letter. Now, there's a couple things you can't read because of the way Sansa is holding the thing, and there's like a part of it's curled over itself, but the parts that are able to be deciphered are, "You promised to protect me. Now you have a chance to fulfill your promise. Knights of the Vale are under your command. Ride north for Winterfell. Lend us your aid, and I shall see that you are rewarded."
Well, that sounds like it's going to a very specific person.
Yeah. So, and you know, is this a dumb Sansa storyline? Is this a smart Sansa storyline? I guess the outcome determines that, right?
Right. Like, if this works and she gets Littlefinger to contribute to this battle in a way that helps them, and he doesn't just service himself, then maybe.
But there's also, like, the quadrants of success where, like, you've got, you know, good methodology leading to good results, good methodology leads to bad results, bad methodology leading to good results, and bad methodology leading to bad results. And what if this is a case of bad methodology? Because essentially you're saying if she was correct to trust Littlefinger, then this will work out. I don't think that anyone in any universe could be described as correct in trusting Littlefinger.
Right, but
so she follows her instincts. Her instincts are false. Whether Littlefinger turns out to be true, I don't know that I can give Sansa credit for that.
Well, I mean, we don't know what her plan is yet, and like that's the thing. I don't know if she thinks she can outplay him at his own game, and maybe she can, maybe she can't. But I don't necessarily know that she trusts him. More like they're going to do this anyway. Jon and Davos are going to send all of their troops at Ramsay So why not at least try and get something going?
What if there's a way to square the circle? What if she is bypassing Littlefinger and writing directly to Robin Aaron?
Oh, Jesus.
Who is an idiot, but he has some kind of feelings for his cousin.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe romantic feelings. Even though the last time I think they met, yeah, she slapped him silly. And
right. Right. there was that scene where he got a little weird in the courtyard there. And like...
Sure.
The castle scene, the sand castle or snow castle, whatever.
But to the extent that he still is in the command of the Vale and Littlefinger right. can only control him via proxy, what if Sansa tries to decide she's going to cut out the middleman?
Sure.
That would kind of be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd have to believe that, like, I mean, I guess that's something that Littlefinger would want to do anyway, because he was kind of manipulating him into doing that. So
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the difference would be there, except for if that's Sansa writing him directly to kind of earn some affection towards him, and then she tries to throw her hand into the manipulation to kind of insulate her. And also, whatever Littlefinger's game is, I don't think he intends to destroy Jon Snow and Sansa Stark.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it.
It seems like his best play is to back the new Starks and have them feel indebted to him so he sews up control of the North or mm-hmm. the support of the North.
Yeah, he's certainly using them in his plan, but I don't think he's actively trying to harm them.
Okay. If you want to read it yourself, I'll include this link. There'll be a lot of links in the show notes this week if you want to kind of take a gander at the note and verify its authenticity. For yourself. Next up, we have Brett C. that wanted our thoughts on speculation on some things that occurred to me after Sunday's episode. In the books, I seem to remember John going to the Hill Clansmen, who Gurm writes as being kind of south of the wall wildlings. If I remember correctly, there is a huge plot point because this is a huge plot point because John was going through this whole we don't have enough men debate. Remembers there's this huge pool of super Stark loyal warriors that everyone has overlooked. Do you think the show will follow a similar path? It kind of seems like it would solve a lot of their problems unless the end game is for John to lose something else, like a double turn of Umbers or Manderlys to save John. So. What he's saying is, like, there's these hill tribes, these mountain mm-hmm. clansmen that are, like, these very small houses, but they are super loyal to Jon Stark, and they're also considered themselves, like, uber northern men. I don't know if it's fair to call them, like, wildlings. They just are less concerned with titles and nobilities than the Northmen, who, as we've discussed, you know, a little bit briefly in this week's podcast, are not that concerned with it in the first place. And I'm wondering that... I feel like that with the show's talk of him trying to go after the smaller houses, that they might be kind of doing a remix of this anyway. But I don't know. We'll see. There is a really badass quote. And to kind of make a minor correction to Brett's point here, John was trying to recruit for Stannis because Stannis is going to liberate Winterfell. That's something that John mm-hmm. kind of supported, and he couldn't give any of his men because he didn't want to enter into the war himself at this point. Wildings wouldn't fight for Stannis, of course, so he suggested, hey, I'm going to tell you how to butter up these northern lords. I'm going to tell you how to play on their support and their sympathies, and then you can go and recruit themselves. And Stannis and Davos go and do just that. But there's really this badass quote because at this point, Stannis is marching on Winterfell, just as in the books in the show, it was gotten snowy and stormy, and they're getting bogged down. And the southern lords are, like, despairing, because, you know, they're not used to all this shit. And one of them asks the leader of the most prominent leader of the Hills people, you know, do you want to die here? And the guy responded, his name is Hugo Wool. He says, no, I want to live forever in a land where summer lasts 1,000 years. I want a castle in the clouds where I can look down over the world. I want to be 6 and 20 again. When I was 6 and 20, I could fight all day and fuck all night. But what men want does not matter. Winter is almost upon us, boy, and winter is death. I would sooner my men die fighting for Ned Stark's little girl than alone and hungry in the snow, weeping tears that freeze upon their cheeks. No one sings songs of men who die like that. As for me, I am old, and this will be my last winter. Let me bathe and bolt in blood before I die. I want to feel it spatter across my face when my axe bites deep into a Bolton skull. I want to lick it off my lips and die with the taste of it on my tongue.
Mm, okay.
Mm. So if we get something like that in the show, I totally support a northern a mountain clan campaign for John. But I don't know. It seems like they're going to shortcut this with some kind of Littlefinger trickery and Knights of the Vale, and they're kind of going to ride in to save John's ass. At what point does Sansa tell John about this, by the way?
Does she?
Man, she has to. Like, it's one thing if you just do it, like, if you essentially beg for forgiveness rather than ask for permission. But if you don't, if you let Jon ride into battle not knowing that you've contacted Littlefinger and asked for the support from the Knights of the Vale, like, that's just stupid.
Yeah. I think if they want to make it cool, like, Jon is ready to go in, and no one has come to their aid yet. They still only have the 2,500 men or whatever. And Sansa goes to him and says, look, I've contacted the Knights of the Vale. And Jon's just like, have you heard back?
Yeah.
Have they responded at all? And she has to say no. And then he goes in, and then things look bad. And at the last moment, they swoop in and save the day. I don't know. It would be a huge coincidence of timing.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it's going to be. I don't think they're going to hold off. Like, sure. John and Davos don't seem... Unless they get a raven back immediately that says, yeah, we're coming, wait.
Right.
Because they're ready to go right now.
Yeah.
With what they've got.
And they're not... I mean, that's the thing. Like, you could easily say this is dumb John, because instead of waiting for the men he needs, he's just going to attack. But on the other hand, John knows that... That's why I say it's like, it might be simplistic to say it's dumb Sansa, because John is not listening to Sansa, and he thinks that, hey, we could get snowed in here and then we're fucked and we can't do anything and we'll just die. We'll starve and we'll die. Sansa's saying, well, we don't have enough men to take Winterfell. I mean, it's kind of like they're at an impasse. So John's going to march and Sansa's going to try to recruit. And, you know, I guess they're both low percentage chances, because, again, I just don't trust Littlefinger. Even though I don't see any motive for him to screw over Sansa in this case, I just don't trust him.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you're right, though. It seems like the letter could be going to Robin.
That would be most interesting, because then she's got a chance of keeping, of even deposing Littlefinger, because it seems like his primary strength right now is that he has the Knights of the Vale behind him.
Yeah,
he's not part of King's Landing's court anymore. I'm pretty sure that when and if the Lannisters find out all the shit that he's done behind their backs, he's going to be in trouble. So if she can pry those knights out of his fingers with a direct appeal to her cousin, it's interesting. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about some crazy Arya theories?
Why not?
Before we get into the craziest one, I want to pass on something Andrew L. shared, that right before the preseason hype, there was an interview on Hello Magazine, I think is how you pronounce it, with Maisie Williams and Sophie Turner.
Mm-hmm.
And they played the classic Two Truths and a Lie game with the journalists.
Sure.
Sophie's truths were this. Ramsay dies. Well, I'm not saying truths. Her statements were this. Ramsay dies.
Okay.
Lady Stoneheart returns. Arya checks three people off her list. So one of those, the other thing is that Sophie and Maisie could just be fucking with these guys, because they're under no obligation to
they could tell three
breach
lies.
Their contract. And Maisie said Arya goes to Westeros back over the sea. Arya is in the trailer more times than people have realized, because they don't realize it's her. And three, Arya doesn't cross any more names off her list. So,
I think that last one feels like a lie to me, especially when paired with the Sophie thing.
The Arya checks three people off her list. So, what's your gut tell me? Because I kind of want to believe that the third one, the Arya checks three people off her list and Arya checks no one, are the lies, which means Ramsay Bolton dies and Lady Stoneheart returns.
Right. That all kind of feels right to me.
Arya going back to Westeros feels like it's the reason I'm getting into this at all is because the second statement, Arya's in the trailer more times than people have realized because they don't realize it's her.
Yeah.
Has birthed a shit ton of, you know, Arya is wearing this mask, Arya's wearing that mask, Jaqen's wearing this mask, which, you know, those things are just essentially blatant statements. To tell them is to give you the theory that Jaqen H'ghar, for some reason, is wearing an Arya mask. Now, people say, but Aeron, but Jim, how can he have Arya's face? But yet, when Arya stole the face from the first from the House of Black and White the first time, and she came back, and Jaqen gave the whole for a person who's not no one, a face is as good as poison. Mm-hmm. She starts ripping off the masks of the Jaqen who's lies dead at her feet.
Yeah.
Very last face that she gets to after she rips off like a half dozen is her own.
Yeah.
Now
she's clearly not dead in that scene.
A lot of people now. So there's a couple things here. A lot of people say, "Well, but they've showed them physically flinging the masks off of people, so there's got to be a component to it." And two, she was obviously drugged at the and poisoned at the time, so maybe this is all a hallucination.
Right.
But on the other hand, yes, she was being poisoned, but her vision didn't start to blur and her eyes didn't go white until after she'd seen her own face.
Mm-hmm.
So. That you're kind of really up in the air about whether it's absolute a complete requirement that you need to have a dead face to change your face.
Right. And the more I think about it, the less likely it seems that that's the case.
And that the other theory is like, well, Arya's put a face on someone else, some random person that doesn't even know they're in trouble.
Put a face on someone else?
Yeah, like she just grabs some urchin off the street and says, hey, you want to make some money? And like, yeah, and she flips him a gold coin.
Is that
she just
something
kinda...
we've ever seen them able to do?
What?
The faceless men.
I mean, put a face on someone else?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Well, then that seems a little far-fetched.
Sure. Well, I'm just laying some of the theories.
Right.
But the interesting one is getting a lot of play is summed up by Cherie from London. She says, I want to draw your attention to a popular tinfoil theory on the interwebs that Arya is the waif. Some speculate that Arya is having a Fight Club moment and wrestling with her past and present identities.
Ugh.
This would
Already don't like it.
This would explain why the waif seems to know everything about her when they play the Would I Lie to You game, and why the waif has a personal vendetta against Arya when she should be a well-trained no one. People have also noticed that nobody ever seems to see the waif apart from Jaqen and Arya, and this would explain why nobody cared when the waif was battering a blind Arya on the streets of Braavos. It also explains why her assassination was such a sloppy job.
You remember in Liar Liar where Jim Carrey goes to the bathroom and beats the shit out of himself?
Sure, yeah.
The people who saw that had a reaction.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What the hell are you doing? What does he say?
I'm kicking my own ass.
Right.
Yeah.
So I would think if a beggar girl was in the streets whipping her own ass, people would probably take notice, regardless of whether it was an invisible waif or
whatnot. Yeah, and there
whatnot.
Was this, another piece of evidence that people use is the fact that, like, when Arya was fighting the waif on one of those fights, they pull out in a long shot of her down after the waif just disappears, and Arya's just swinging in fury at nothing.
Right.
And they're like, oh, this is what people are actually seeing her do, just, like, act crazy in the streets.
You can say that.
But here's
I've got a counterpoint.
Okay, give me your counterpoint, because I've got one that I think is just an absolute stopper.
I think this is an absolute stopper, depending on... what you think?
Well,
Jaqen's
sure.
Talking
in a world
about.
Of magic where people can magically put on faces, this is my idea of a stopper. Yeah.
So there's the scene, you know, one of the training scenes after she comes back to the hall, where she's fighting the waif, and the waif goes unarmed, kicks her ass. Jaqen walks in. She says, "You'll never be one of us," to Arya.
Sure.
And Jaqen goes, "The girl has a point." He's talking to Arya in response to something that waif said.
Which I guess if I was a Fight Club Game of Thrones conspiracist, I would say, well, he actually came in having Arya Arya having an argument with herself that sounds like she's expressing self-doubt, and he's just affirming that.
And he doesn't go like, what happened in this room?
Yes.
Arya's upside down on her fucking neck. She's got a broken teeth and a bruised nose.
Yeah.
What just happened in here?
So I think even a better stopper is when the waif reports back to Jaqen after she's donned a disguise and in a kind of a third-person point of view seen Arya's betrayal or failure to execute the mission against the actress.
Right.
She goes back to report to Jaqen and say, I knew she was never going to make it, and I want your permission to kill you. And then Jaqen says, yeah, fine. If you believe that the waif is Arya, who the fuck are they talking about?
Right.
Some people go so far as to say that Jaqen is a figment of Arya's imagination. And I'm just like, no. If that ends out to be true, I think I will like it less. Like, it's a great theory, but those two points we just made, I feel like, are the stoppers. And if they proceed past those stoppers, I don't know how I'm going to feel about it. Actually, I do know. I feel like I'm going to be cheated.
Yeah, I just don't think it's true.
Because that's the thing about the Fight Club, is that that thing works when you think back and all the interactions yep. that have been had. It's very internally consistent, much the same like the Sixth Sense is. And it plays kind of fair with you. I don't know. Because, again, you have to explain. Either Jacken's a figment of Arya's imagination, which means he's always been a figment of her imagination, even back in season two where she escaped Harrenhal.
So
Arya just uncovered some badass ability to kill all right. these people that she didn't know she had because she had a psychotic break? That uh-huh. I don't feel like is the truth of what we saw here. Who gave her the iron coin?
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Or maybe that was the real Jacken, and she has never actually met the real Jacken since. I mean,
so now we're crossing into territory where both Jacken and the Waif are Fight Club hallucinations.
Are like, parts, and also they're not consistent. They're variable depending on how badly you need the theory to work at any one point.
Right.
And I'm not shitting on a theory because it's, you know, the theory itself, I think, is an interesting idea. But the one thing that's frustrating is nobody in the Reddit threads were saying these points where, well, what about, like, you know, it'd be one thing if every scene always had Arya and the Waif and Jacken never made eye contact with the Waif and all. But no, he's right. speaking to her and she's speaking to him and they're speaking about a person that has to be Arya.
Right.
You know?
Right, it's so weird.
His response isn't, a girl has lost her mind. It's, you know...
And I mean, all the rebuttals and stuff that we're giving to our objections here, kind of playing devil's advocate, people in the Reddit threads would be doing that as well. But every time you do that, you chip away at the theory, right?
Sure.
Like, every hoop you have to jump through to explain away
yes.
the problems with the theory is one less brick in that fucking wall.
Right.
And eventually it just crumbles.
Right. And that's the thing, like, I think that it seems to me that you've either got the fact that Arya actually was... There's another theory I saw that Arya learned how to do fake blood from the mummers.
Fake
she's
blood?
She's essentially wearing, like, a bladder of fake blood that she can squirt out to fool the Waif. I don't know that that's satisfying.
Right.
She's essentially fake.
Okay.
She knew the Waif was coming. She's faking her death so she won't look. But then it's like,
why is she so horrified? Why?
Yeah, why wouldn't she just smugly pull herself out of the canal and be like, yeah. hey, hey. The other one is
in
like,
case
well,
she's
maybe,
still watching?
Maybe Jacken's pretending to be Arya.
Right.
And this is a test for the Waif and the Waif's fight. But again, why is this version of Arya, who is actually Jacken, stumbling about confused in the streets of Braavos?
Right.
And the third possibility is that one that actually kind of makes internal sense is the Jacken, or that Arya has conjured her face upon some innocent person who she set up as a patsy, mm-hmm. who is stabbed, dumped into the thing, somehow manages to do a bunch of acrobatic moves to jump off the bridge, and then survives long enough, bleeding in the canal, to walk confused because, why did this happen? I took a gold coin from a girl and now I'm being stabbed. Like...
Right.
I feel like the answer is going to be D, something way cooler than what we're actually thinking.
Right, because there is the problem of, we don't know that the Faceless Men can even do that for the
yes.
third one. So
yes.
that also requires a little hand-waving.
Okay, Clegane Bowl theories. Tyler S. said, a lot of people are here saying that there's a lot of logistical hurdles involved in getting the Hound into the Clegane Bowl. But I think it could be accomplished fairly easily. One, the Hound finds the group that killed Septon Maribold and his people. I guess this guy's actual name is Septon Roy.
Roy? That seems...
I think.
A little pedestrian.
I didn't even pay attention because I knew he was Septon Maribold, so fuck you.
Yeah.
So anyway, the Hound finds a group that killed the Septon and his people. Two, they recognize him as the Hound and tell him about the rumors of a resurrected mountain in King's Landing. Alternatively, he overhears them discussing said rumors before his confrontation with them. Three, the Hound either cuts everyone down or barely escapes with his life. Four, the Hound seeks out his brother in King's Landing. In King's Landing, point five, the Hound meets the High Sparrow, who has also met Septon Maribold in his travels and remembers him fondly. Six, the Hound agrees to fight for the Faith, both to honor Septon Maribold and get revenge on his brother. Step seven, the I guess this track's fine. All you got to know, he has to deal with the Brotherhood without banners. Now that is a big thing, because if it's the true Brotherhood, that means they already have bad blood, because in his mind they cheated him out of the gold and silver that he had, because they essentially took that from him as a tax when he had his trial by combat. Two, if we're right and the Brotherhood Without Banners includes Lady Stoneheart, I don't feel like the Hound is just going to roll them up. I guess the best way I could see this is if this Brotherhood Without Banners is actually a kind of amalgam of the Bloody Mummers. The Hound tracks them down and kills them. At the same time, the Brotherhood Without Banners catches them up and says, "Oh, you killed the guys we were looking for. By the way, your brother's still alive and King just, you know, sharing news with him." And that makes him like, "Well, fuck that. I'm going to go." And then the rest of Tyler's theory could track, I guess. Because I do like the fact that this kind of jumps Septon, who's kind of like more in, you know, preaching the love than the law and the scripture, would be friendly at least with the High Sparrow, who again was just kind of like this beggar priest before Cersei anointed him as the High Septon. I guess that all tracks pretty cleanly. Do you have any thoughts about it?
I don't know. I mean, the hardest thing to imagine to me is how he's going to end up, you know, in King's Landing without problems, because like he's definitely not welcome in King's Landing at the moment.
And so, he's a big fucker. It'd be hard for him to sneak in. He's not Arya. He's not even Jaime.
Right.
He's this big, tall dude with visible facial scars. Even you throw a cloak on him, he's still this big fucking dude.
Right. His size, his appearance, it's all working against him in King's Landing. Now, I'm sure the High Septon could sneak him in.
That's true.
If he knew about him. But
yeah, if he was traveling with the faithful and they wanted to hide him in some kind of, you know, cart filled with hay or whatever hoary medieval trope you want to throw out, I guess that could all work. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
They just build a giant horse.
Yeah.
A giant wooden horse. Wheel it up to the gates.
It's a gift for King Tommen. It's a gift for Cersei. Moving on to Chris H. says, given that Sir Gregor is an undead abomination creation of Qyburn's, do you think his necromancy will be exposed during or as a result of the trial by combat? Will he still be capable of fighting if the Hound manages to behead him? Do you believe his magic is similar to that of the Night's King or the Children? Is this destined to be another unanswered question? Perhaps on this podcast, because I don't know that I have satisfying answers. Let's talk this through. We do know that there's whispers on a small council about this abomination, and no one's really happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that the High Sparrow just says, "Hey, this is the work of necromancy. He cannot be your champion." Like in the trial by combat, you can't have the devil fighting for you in a trial by combat. You can't have a work of evil fighting for you because this is determined to God's will. This person was already supposed to be dead. You brought him back to life and contrary to the God's will. So I'm just going to categorically deny you the ability to.
My question is just how much power does this guy have?
The High Septon?
Yeah. Is he the one running running the show here, or is Tommen and Marjorie? Like,
well, so that goes back to Varys's riddle about who has the power, the merchant, the merchant, the king, or the priest.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that right now, there's a struggle going on for the hearts of the people, where it seems like they're the ones who have the power at the moment, between Queen Marjorie, Tommen, and the High Sparrow. Mm-hmm. So the thing is if Marjorie goes against the High Septon, she's probably going to win on a lot of issues, but everyone except for maybe Tommen hates Cersei.
Mm-hmm.
So if the High Septon said she's got a devil for her champion, I feel like the people would be like, "Yeah, damn right. This mountain guy is terrible. He's got a long history of fucking us small folk. We don't like him. We don't like the fact he's brought back to the dead by your freaky deaky maester,"
mm-hmm.
"and get him the fuck out of here."
Yeah, could be. I mean, that's anticlimactic for the Clegane Bowl, but
yeah, which makes me think that it's not actually going to happen. Is he still capable of fighting if the Hound managed to behead him? I don't know. In the books, it's heavily implied that there is no head in Sir Robert De Strong's helmet. It's just empty.
No head at all?
No head
just
at
empty?
All.
Oh, just empty? Oh, man.
Because I think that Bran has a green-seeing vision of the mountain wearing the Kingsguard armor, which the helm lifts up and it's just blackness, and then like Stanley Kubrick style, the shining blood just fountains out of it.
All right. Well, then, I mean, I don't know what to say about that, because no rules apply if that's the case. I mean, could you slice off one of his arms and it hovers in the air next to him and still right. attacks? Like,
because in the show, I feel like if, you know, in the books, it's very mysterious what the fuck, how Qyburn did it. Is it some kind of blood magic? Is it some kind of, you know, is it purely magical? Whereas in the show, it seems like it's much more of a Frankenstein, poorly understood science than a purely magic
mix
thing.
Up a couple potions.
Sure.
And,
yeah. Put some, you know, get some electricity generated, clamp it onto his nipples.
Mm-hmm.
Presto, you got Robert the Strong. I don't know. The magic's similar to the Night's King or no, I don't actually believe that. But that, you know, that I guess that's a question about how you perceive magic working. Is it all flowing from one source? Is a good and evil duality, the Lord of Light versus the others in the darkness? Is it like, you know, various factions of different gods have different types of powers and abilities? Like, that's a very, like, what do you believe kind of question at this point.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. Is there anything else we should talk about on that?
I don't think so.
Hey, guess what? Bald Move is a self-funded enterprise. We're independent podcasters. We don't have a parent organization that pays for our production and our research or any of our time period. It's all by very small amount of advertising, as you've probably noticed, and also direct fan support. We try to make it worth your while. If you go to club.baldmove.com, you can find out how, for as little as a buck a month, you can get ad-free feed podcasts, VIP forums, bonus content, such as we just did a playthrough of the final episode of season one of Telltale's Game of Thrones video game, where we essentially tried to ruin House Forrester. that's the way we try to play the game, the way you probably didn't play through it if you did, or you wouldn't play through it if you decide to in the future. I thought we did a decent amount of carnage.
Yeah.
If you're on the fence about whether it's something to be up your alley, I've made the first episode of this season public. I'll include that link in the show notes so you can kind of get an idea of what we're about. But it seems like people like them. But regardless, again, you get a lot of other bonus features. We have extra weekly podcasts, sometimes more than one. We're going to watch, by the time this is airing, or by the time you're downloading it, we'll have a spoiler podcast for The Conjuring 2, the very first scary movie I've seen in the dark in a theater.
What? The Witch wasn't scary?
Well, that definitely is a scary movie, but I guess not the kind of, like, there certainly wasn't a crowd. Yeah. There was like six people in the audience, including me, you, and Cecily. So yeah. I'm hoping there'll be more and people will be screaming and yelling and I'll get that classic, you know. I want to be the guy in being filmed in with the night vision goggles. I want to be the guy that throws his popcorn or dumps his Coke on his crotch. I'm
you
hoping.
Just go to YouTube for that. Reaction videos. My reaction to The Conjuring 2.
Can it be night vision?
I shit myself and died.
There you go. That's going to be, that's something that only the club members.
It's a 3-day long video because the guy literally died on stream and the cops had to come and it was all live stream.
I'm trying to sell Club Bald Move memberships here, god damn it. Club.baldmove.com. It's a buck a month. You can see Jim shit himself and night vision. That's a guarantee. Thanks for your support. Zach B was the first to mention this. The next three show names that were leaked in German, but people were able to translate it. And I think it's since then been confirmed in English in different sites.
Mm-hmm.
Episode 608 is No One. And his analysis is obviously we're talking about Arya Stark here. One can only hope this episode marks the end of her seemingly perpetual stick training, finally giving her the chance to leave Braavos and play a little more of an active role in the struggles of House Stark. Indeed. Very also strong possibility there are very, very small likelihood of her actually staying dead if the next episode is called No One. So episode 609 is The Battle of the Bastards.
Okay, Snow and Ramsay. Gotta be, right?
Zach B says, again, it's not exactly hard to figure out who's being talked about here. What's interesting, though, is that the tease climactic battle between Jon Snow and Ramsay Bolton won't be in the season finale, suggesting there might be a giant twist in store. Which leads to 610, The Winds of Winter. With a title like that, you can pretty much bet Season 6 will close on the White Walkers charging a full-on assault on the Wall, with the suggestion being that they may even be successful in bringing it down.
I hear that's going to be 69 minutes long. Longest episode of Game of Thrones ever.
So I think I read that the last three episodes are going to be over 60 minutes long.
Yeah.
They're all going to be like historically long episodes, which is interesting because we've had some historically short episodes up till nine. Like some of them have been like coming in at 50 minutes.
Yeah.
My question is, where does the Clegane Bowl fit in here? I guess you could shoehorn it into anyone, but... You know, Battle of the Bastards, they're true-born sons of whatever bastard Clegane
but they're
side
kind of
them.
They're kind of in-spirit bastards, right? Like
they're right bastards, sure.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're cross-grained bastards.
Uh-huh.
I guess, but that feels like a pretty epic, that's going to be like an epic battle for supremacy in the North. Maybe one of those Battle of the Blackwater where you never cut away from it.
Right, and I was thinking, like, where does Jaime's stuff fit in there and River Run? Because we know that stuff's got to go down soon. There's a lot of stuff that just needs to happen running up to the end of this season, and it's hard to see where it all fits.
The other thing I want to talk about is there's another thread on Reddit where people screenshotted, you know, famous... So I watched, and I'm sure a lot of people did, the preview for next week where Cersei comes up to... Was it Lancel?
Yeah,
and she says, you know, if you don't leave, there'll be violence. And she says, I choose violence. Mm-hmm. And then later on in the trailer for next episode, it shows Cersei walking and the mountain is behind her. And he's got his armor's kind of bloodied.
Yes.
And he's got these prominently on his chest. There's this 4-pointed gouge that matches up exactly to what it would look like if they hit him with those 4-pronged hammers.
Awesome.
So that implies to me that Cersei goes against the Faith of the Seven, the Faith Militant, and prevails.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, did she prevail hard enough that there is not going to be a trial by combat?
Because
I'm trying to think of a way of like that the mountain and her gets repelled, but the Faith Militant are still standing.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe they... That's a good question. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I can't come up with anything.
But I'm pretty sure that you're not going to have... Like, there's just not enough time to... Like, the next episode, the Hound has to figure out what's going on with the Brotherhood of that Banners before he can go to King's Landing, and the mountain has to be fighting there with Cersei. There's no way that you're going to have the Clegane Bowl there, which means it's got to be at 6:09 or 6:10.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Maybe it can be... Because the Winds of Winter, that could be the tease. Like... The wall, like what people widely speculate of Bran coming south of the wall and the White Walker, that the Night King putting his hand on the ground and causing an earthquake that destroys the wall. Yeah. That'd be a hell of a final shot.
Yeah.
So it could be like you could have the Clegane Bowl and all that other shit happening in this episode. And that also seems to give it a little bit of room to breathe. Because 6:08, you know, Sandor tracks down the Brotherhood, settles his business there. 6:09, he goes to King's Landing. 6:10, they set up the... I don't know. It just seems. Yeah. It almost seems like there's not enough time to do all this stuff. But when you're dealing with 70-minute episodes,
yeah,
you know that's essentially another half episode you can fit in there.
Yeah, there are a couple of other things from the trailer that I don't know if you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, let's talk about it now.
There's one scene that looks like where somebody takes a running leap off a balcony.
I would say no one takes a leap off about
right. A lot of people are speculating, oh, is that Jaqen? Is that Arya?
It looks like Arya.
She could be running from the wave, but she seems very
not stabbed in the gut.
Yeah, very nimble for someone who just got multiple stab wounds,
which again, you and I both believe that there's some kind of Ocean's 11 style misdirection going on. We just don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I'm glad, because if any of these theories you talked about so far turn out to be literally true, that means that it was obvious, and I'm hoping that they've got something that's not obvious, but still makes sense in retrospect.
That's important.
Yeah,
And I also saw there was a dump of some still shots for the next episode where it shows the Waif kind of stalking through the city a bit. And behind her in this darkened hall, a hallway, is the outline of what looks like it could be Syrio. Like, the stance and the silhouette look very much like a Syrio Forel type character.
Oh, boy. All right, so I want to read this from Corinne. that was sent in. She's from the UK. She says, following The Broken Man here in the UK, I was watching Thronecast, which is a TV show which does a similar job to you guys. She's talking about Bald Move.
Thronecast is a TV
show? It's a TV show, yeah. Just on the Beeb.
BBC?
Yeah. And I've seen it before. It's been referenced in other podcasts, and they usually have like celebrities on. It's similar to what you guys do, where they talk about the show and had added celebrity and show-based guest on the sofa or couch for the Yanks. Hey, I know what a fucking sofa is. This isn't your Lorries or your Bubblers or your, you know, faggots. Boots. That you smoke.
Right.
We use sofa too, all right?
Or your pants.
Pants? What?
Yeah, their pants are not pants. They're underwear.
What?
Yeah. That's what they call their underwear, pants.
What do they call pants?
Knickers.
What do they call knickers then?
Actually, I don't know. I don't know what they call pants, but pants are underwear in the UK.
Okay, because I thought knickers is underwear too.
I think it is.
All right, so it's slacks,
it's all
trousers.
They don't have a name for pants. It's all underwear over there.
Pantaloons.
Uh-huh.
Okay, anyway, on this fucking sofa was actor. We call it the crouch hammock. The crotch hammock.
Or the butt sling.
The butt sling, yeah. Sure. The ass pillows. Or arse pillows for you.
Right.
On the sofa was actor Miltos Yerlimu.
Miltos Yerlimu.
Yep, who plays Cyril Farrell.
Okay.
I've not been a big subscriber to Cyril Farrell as Jack and Hagar theory, though watching the show has made me rethink. Firstly, when questioned about this theory by the presenter, he was incredibly vague and started talking about the mythology of the show, and he didn't confirm nor deny. Okay, fine. Be vague, I thought, but then when asked a question, Sirio has had some history with the House of Black and White, right? He said yes immediately, but then backtracked and said, oh, no. I mean, history with Braavos, of course. All this is as fishy as House Tully. I watched the interview, and I thought he's just being standard level actor, playful, evasive about the future of him being on a show. I see this fucking thing.
Yeah.
And I think about what my little boy heart wants, and I'm starting to think that Jackin equals Sirio equals
maybe
is right on, which implies.
Yeah.
It depends. Like, if Sirio just comes back to save her, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. If they imply that Sirio is Jackin Hagar, then I've started to wonder. You know, I mentioned that the Faceless Men might have this princess that was promised kind of prophecy, and Arya is significant to them in a way that's beyond just a talented new recruit. And if he's actually Jackin,
uh-huh,
and he's been training Arya since the beginning of season one, then I start to think that like there's something significant to Arya beyond even what we suspect on the show.
How about this? I have an alternate theory for you.
Okay.
What if he's Waif? What if he's the Waif?
Because
he has
Waif?
Been doing, specifically, he's the Waif, and he has been doing her combat training. And maybe Jackin doesn't even know that he's the Waif.
So why would he stab her in the guts? And why is he standing behind her when it's clear there's clearly two people?
Because it's not Arya.
Who's not Arya?
Arya's not Arya in that scene. It's Jackin.
So the Waif is Sirio.
The Waif is Sirio. Arya is Jackin. And Cereal kills Jackin in that scene.
Why would Arya be running around? Why would Jackin be running around as Arya? If he's...
To test the Waif. So I'm expounding on the theory that Jackin is Arya, and this is a test for the Waif, who is actually Cereal.
So then why would...
Who
the,
went to Braavos
why would
to...
Jackin as Arya be wandering, confused, bleeding from the gut if he
That's
expected
fair.
Her
That's
to
fair.
Attack? Yeah, it's like I feel like if I do enough Socratic method, we'll poke a hole in this theory.
None of the theories are really particularly good, but
that fucking looks like Cyril Farrell. Now
it does, and it's interesting because it's framed kind of as the Waif's shadow in that shot.
Yeah.
So
I'm going to have to include this in my show notes too. The other thing I want to mention is that a lot of people pointed out that my smoking gun about Arya walking past another person that looks just like Arya in her oysters, clams, and cockles routine is that apparently the show is lousy.
Probably.
Like, this is just a Braavosy style of dress.
I assumed so.
It'd be like if you found a girl in southern Ohio in the fall wearing Uggs and a Han Solo vest. Like, oh my God, they're the same people. There's literally thousands of them.
With
like,
bleach blonde, brown. brown rooted hair.
Sure, like, sure. Like that, no, that's just kind of the style, even down to the little weird bun thing she's got in her temple. So it could be that there were several in the crowd with the movie she was watching. There were several in the streets that when she was running around as a beggar.
Yeah.
So it's not conclusive proof that that is Arya, you know, being fake Arya and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know what the hell's going on, but like, I'm super excited about the Cyril Pharrell stuff.
Okay.
Super cool. Abigail McGim says, I was wondering if you could provide some insight or give your opinion as to why Sansa, Jon, and Davos did not go to House Reed for support against the Boltons. I know the Greywater Watch is a moving castle, but I think they are in desperate need for men of House Reed, and have always the men of House Reed have always been one of the Starks' most loyal allies and would certainly fight alongside of them. So
this is all you. I don't know anything about their history aside from the Tower of Joy stuff.
Well,
and the rebellion stuff.
My thought was when the Reed children showed up, the Howland Reed is kind of very much a behind the scenes lord.
Okay.
And he doesn't show up to the big events, and he's kind of, you know, they're known as a reclusive people. And Jojen and Mira showed up after Arya and Ned and Sansa and Jon had left Winterfell. It was at that point just Bran, Rickon, and the Maester and Hodor, right? And okay. Asha. And their mother was gone. Like, there was nobody. Like would Jon know that House Reed exists and they are super loyal allies? Would Sansa know that? I don't have any evidence that they would.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm sure they're aware of them.
Yeah.
But they're one of the most southern of the northern lords. They're literally at the neck, which is the divide. They live in the neck, which is the swampish dividing line between north and south Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that they wouldn't think they could get down that far south. Like, you know, you're south of Winterfell at that point. It might be too late for a recruiting run, or they might just be unaware of the special relationship that Ned has with Howland. Although Bran was aware of the story that Howland and Ned fought together at the Tower of Joy. I don't know. I just feel like that maybe they don't know how loyal they are, and also they're just too far south. It's essentially the same reason they just don't go on down the River Run mm-hmm. themselves and try to get their Blackfish uncle, great uncle. So that's the only thing I come up with there, Abigail. Avril F. says, on the Broken Man episode, you're talking about how Brienne has claimed that she killed Stannis. As she's usually true to her word, you wondered why she would lie, talking about the Stannis is alive theory.
I don't think she did lie, but yes, go on.
Maybe she spared Stannis on the condition that he infiltrates Winterfell. Why her vow to avenge Renly is important to her, I can see her giving it up for aid in her current mission to protect Sansa. Stannis has a reputation for justice and upholding his word. As an example, see Davos's amputated fingers. Brienne might have been convinced that he would fulfill his promise to infiltrate the castle, but would ultimately die carrying out his duties, which is why she would say that he is dead. Stannis knew that if he didn't make the promise, she'd kill him anyways, so he would carry it out as he knows that he's already defeated during this battle, and he also had just murdered his daughter. This was all, I think the topic of this email was the ghost of Winterfell. So she's proposing that Stannis plays the ghost of Winterfell from the books. My thought is Stannis was like kind of mortally wounded. He was moving stiffly, and also he's Stannis fucking Baratheon.
How
does he infiltrate? Yeah. He is the one that the Boltons are looking to kill, et cetera, yada, yada. Why in the world
and they're
would
set
he...
for like siege warfare.
Yes.
Like, they're not going to let somebody stumble in and then not notice that it's Stannis.
This guy is a guy who can barely walk and who's been wounded many times and is probably going to die of succumb to his wounds if Brienne doesn't kill him.
Yeah.
So it's a cool theory, but I don't see how his fame and notoriety and his poor health would allow him to become the ghost of Winterfell without some kind of inside help.
Mm-hmm.
There are probably still people loyal to the Starks in Winterfell. We already knew there's that one old woman who mm-hmm. got flayed because somehow, you know, Ramsay found out about her. But I'm sure there's other people that could help, but I don't know. I just still feel like that Stannis is dead.
Yeah.
Someone wrote in
I'm working under.
who was kind of poking gentle fun at the people saying that, well, we didn't see Stannis die, so by law of Game of Thrones, you can't say he's conclusively dead. He's like, oh, yeah, well, we never saw Theon get his cock cut off.
I mean, not directly.
Right.
We saw some sausage links at some point.
Yeah. Sausage links, but they're not, those aren't cocks. And yeah, they sent a box that says Theon's favorite toy, but they didn't see the cock. So maybe he's still rocking around with his cock.
Sure.
So, you know, I know it's not the same, but I just,
yeah,
I guess I would be very surprised if he pops back up. But then again, Benjen was fucking Cold Hand. So what the fuck do I know?
Right. But I mean, we have a character who I trust, Brienne.
Yes. And who has no reason.
Actually saying it on screen, I killed him. It's not like I heard he was killed in the woods somewhere.
I do appreciate Avril at least gave a reason for why she would lie.
Right.
I just don't know with his condition that I think that he could fulfill this mission. Because, yeah, right. Sans, I think Brienne would do that.
I mean, the lie could literally just be to get under Melisandre's skin at the moment, too. Right? Like,
true.
Like, I killed your prince.
But she seems pretty, like, that, to me, I guess, why would she spare? The real answer is,
yeah,
her finding Stannis like that, what, why would she, you have to give a reason why Brienne would spare him. Mm-hmm. And I can't come up with any.
Yeah, me either.
So we already talked about the Game of Thrones couch podcast. I jumped ahead of that. A couple other miscellaneous points. Chrissy says, do you guys think that Davos is going to find out what happened to Shireen since they are camped out exactly at the spot that she was burnt?
Like he stumbles on a grave.
Hey, there's a big pile of ash. Holy shit, there's a child's skull. Ah, Soylent Green is made out of Princess Burn. Oh, I don't know. Yeah, but I guess at this point, I still come back to what I said the last time someone asked me about. What does Davos do with that information? Does he fly into a rage and kill Melisandre, who brought Jon Snow back from the dead?
Yeah.
I mean, she does have power
mm-hmm.
that can be harnessed. And I guess I suspect that Davos knows deep down already.
Yeah, I don't know if he knows directly that she was killed essentially by Melisandre, but
and also
he knows she's dead.
I mean, you could just as easily argue that Stannis killed her.
Sure, yeah.
So
he's the one who had to carry out that order. Melisandre couldn't do it
right
on her own. Yeah, I just don't think it's super important at this point.
Yeah. I mean, it could be dramatically interesting. It's just I can't quite see how they get there. And, you know, we haven't even seen Melisandre, which is kind of weird. We discussed about that, too. I don't know. I'm with you. I think that's just like Davos himself said, it's in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the past, man. He went full Rafiki on it. Troy B. says, while listening to the most recent episode, I heard you say you do not remember Dany ever having any whispers of liking women. But I recall that I believe the first season she got taught some sex moves to perform on Drogo.
Right.
This may not be Dany having a lesbian experience. It shows she at least doesn't shy away from being sexual. So yeah, that was Daria, her servant girl in the show, giving Dany the sex ed. Something I wanted to mention on that show, but I couldn't because it's a book spoiler. Sorta. Is there's also in one of the books where I think she's crossing over the sea to head to Carth.
Is that a metaphor?
but she's having like some sexy thoughts, and she turns to her servant girl, Eerie, to help her out. And she gives her like a hand job that,
right,
like,
okay.
You know, as kind of like her, I guess, she gets down on her buddy. Yeah, she needs some sexual relief. So in the books, they've already kind of show that she's a little bit of a switch hitter.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's nothing to say that this isn't a possibility. And to the extent that Yara / Asha is a remix of, who is the Greyjoy? Victarion, who is sent there to kind of court Dany on behalf of Euron, and who gets in the mind that he's going to court her herself. And to the extent that Yara just said, we need to go make an alliance with the queen, it wouldn't surprise me if she doesn't at least try to come on to her. Now, whether Dany is intrigued by that or says, get the fuck out of here, or I don't know. But, you know, they've laid some tracks here in both the show and the books.
Yeah, and I did not mean to imply that she wouldn't be into it.
Yeah.
I was simply saying, I don't know that we've seen her proof that she would be into it.
Sure. Travis C. said, just listening to your spoiler episode from last week and the Night's King love story got me thinking. What if he didn't fall in love with the White? This is one of those what if. What if he didn't fall in love with the White or White Walker, but instead fell in love with someone north of the Wall, similar to the way Jon fell in love with Ygritte? Ygritte, rather. Maybe she turned into a white, or she was a witch, or she's just a bad influence on the Lord Commander and made the bald move to take the Night Fort for himself. Ygritte is quoted as saying, "We free folk have our stories, too, about one of your king crows found something cold in the woods with bright blue eyes, how he brought her home through your wall and declared himself the Night's King. 13 years he and his queen ruled over his brothers, making sacrifices as black as their cloaks." She continues to explain how the Starks and free folk rallied together to take him down and to free the Night's Watch. Yes, it's a tall tale to tell someone who would bone... Yes, it's a tall tale to say someone would bone down with a zombie, but if she looked anything like Ygritte, cold, blue eyes, knows a thing or two, then I could see how the Lord Commander could break his vow similar to Jon Snow. So, I don't have any problem with this. I mean, this is all, like, old wives' tale legends anyway, and, like,
right.
You know, it's a historical oddity that a black brother fell in love with a white or a white walker, but I could easily, I mean... Think 8,000 years in the future when they're telling the new story of the Long Night. I can imagine someone saying a bastard son of Stark lay with a white walker woman with piercing blue eyes and cold as the night, and it corrupted him and led all of his brothers astray. And, you know, mm-hmm. like I could see this the way legends kind of weave fact and.
Yeah.
And fill in with story and poetic license. I'm fine with that. I don't see how any of that stuff, now that we know the true story, I don't see how any of this stuff is going to be relevant to the plot going forward, though.
Right.
It just seems like, well, those are just legends, and they're half true, half fiction, and here's the real truth that's being presented by the people that would know because they were fucking there.
Sure.
Jennifer G says, something I've been pondering about with this whole R plus L equals J theory. I'm all on board with the theory and hope that we finally get to see whatever happens in the Tower of Joy. But my question is, what is the timeline for Rhaegar and Lyanna quote-unquote falling in love? I'm not a book reader, but it seems that Rhaegar fell for Lyanna at the tournament, and then a few days, weeks, sometime later, they run off together. How long did it take for Ned to get to the Tower of Joy? I assume 9 months, since he would be giving birth, or she would be giving birth at the time he gets there, or was their courtship longer than just a few days? From a show person's perspective, I don't know how long the whole rebellion took place and when Ned finally made it to the tower, but it seems to be quick, and could you help with this? I can help a little bit because the sequence of events is well known and the rough period of time, but the exact sequence is not known because we get the years for some of this happened. We don't know the months. So it's pretty well established that in 281... AC, which is after the conquest of Aegon Targaryen, when he first came over and was crowned king of the Seven Kingdoms, you had, and that's also called the Year of the False Spring, which is also interesting to note about the Robert's Rebellion, is that they took place during the winter, which gives you an idea of how relatively convenient / lack of convenience it is to get around Westeros during the tail end, at least, of a winter. Because this took place in the Year of the False Spring, which is when it got slightly warmer and they thought that winter was over, but nope, it actually lasted for a few more years. This is when you had the famous tourney at Harrenhal, where Rhaegar rode and he won and he crowned Lyanna as the Queen of Love and Beauty. And shortly after, or actually I can't even say shortly, because every source I found said something to the fact that some unknown time later, Rhaegar and Lyanna disappeared together. And that actually could be in the very beginning of the year 282. In 282, Ned's brother found out that Rhaegar had made off with Lyanna, who was betrothed to Robert Baratheon, and he rode up to King's Landing to demand kind of justice, like, you know, what the hell? What's your prince doing abducting our sister and riding off God knows where with her? Mm-hmm. And King Aerys had him thrown in prison. Then he summoned Ned's father... Rickard, and to kind of answer for his son's impetuousness, and there was this he got him there, and they demanded a trial by combat. King Aerys named fire as his champion, and he burnt them to death.
Just fire.
Yeah, fire is the champion for House Targaryen. See how you do about this. It's actually quite a bit more cruel than that, because I think the way it worked is that he set their father on fire, and he had this contraption set up where Brandon Stark, the Ned's brother, was like in some kind of noose with a sword just out of his reach, and that the watching his father being burnt before his eyes drove him mad, and he tried to get to the sword, and he essentially hung himself in his efforts to get to the sword to free him and to save his father.
Okay.
Then King Aerys sent a raven to John Arryn of the Vale, who was had two wards. He was raising Robert Baratheon and Ned Stark and teaching them how to be men. They were living in his castle, and he demanded them to be sent over to him so he could behead them. That's when John Arryn said, "Fuck this," raised his banners, and Robert's rebellion began. This raged until 283 to early. I think early in 283 when it was over, because everyone says that the rebellion took about a year and ended decisively with the sack of King's Landing, which is when King Aerys was killed. But before he did that, he opened the gates to the Lannisters, and the Lannisters' men came through and sacked the city. And of course, Gregor Clegane killed the princess and the Rhaegar's two children, which, you know, is what made Oberyn so pissed off. And that kind of ended, and also shortly after, Ned rode south to retrieve his sister, who was dying at the Tower of Joy. So, there is anywhere between 1 to 2 years that Lyanna and Rhaegar could have been off making love in the Tower of Joy or doing whatever. Now, we don't know that they have all that time, because Rhaegar died at the Trident sometime before King's Landing was sacked, which is in the Riverlands. Bobby Baratheon caved his head in, or his chest in, with his warhammer. So he was separated from Lyanna for some of that time. But what's interesting is that Rhaegar actually at one time believed that his second son, or I guess his first son, his first child was a daughter he had with Aelya Martell. Second son was his second child was the son Aegon, and he thought that Aegon was the prince that was promised. At some point, though, he changed his mind and decided that he needed to try for a third child. And the thing about Aelya is that the last child almost killed her, and the maester said she couldn't have another child. And there's some speculation that Aelya actually supported his quest to fulfill this prophecy, because he very strongly that he had the capacity to bring forth this prince that was promised. And he had the idea that Lyanna Stark, being of ice, and he be from fire, was going to fulfill this thing, this fixation he had with the Song of Ice and Fire. So it could be that he wasn't in love with her so much as that he just wanted to make this kind of sexual magic happen, and kabam.
Right.
So I don't know. That might be more than you were looking for, Jennifer, but that's my understanding of how all that happened. And the other thing is that Aelya, even after Rhaegar left her, there's leads credence that she was kind of supporting this, and she couldn't give him any further children, is that she still was super loyal to the Targaryens and never really spoke ill of Rhaegar, and also loved Rhaegar and her children. I can't remember if Oberyn told this as part of the story that he was telling about his sister, but, you know, it's very common for highborn ladies to give their kids over to like wet nurses after they're born, because they don't want to raise the children.
Sure.
But Aelya insisted on raising all of her children, and she nursed them, and she was there from the beginning until their end. Let's move on to Nikki from Philly. Says, of all the theories I've heard you guys read recently about who Jon will have to kill to fulfill the sword's bloodlust, we're talking about Lightbringer at this point, another Lightbringer theory, why has anyone suggested having him kill Ghost? Maybe a scenario where Ghost saves his life but is mortally wounded, and in the difficult but ultimately kindest thing for Jon to do is to plunge a sword in him to end his suffering. I can't think of anyone Jon loves more, and how much Gurm loves gut-wrenching plot twist. How much more gut-wrenching can you get than for a boy to kill his beloved dog a la Old Yeller style? I actually had two or three people suggest this. Nikki was the first. My response is, I don't see, to the extent that you even have to fulfill any bizarre prophecy to bring apart Lightbringer, which, you know, again, I'm openly skeptical that this is a literal thing that you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how Ghost fulfills that, unless you want to say Ghost is a direwolf and he's associated with Starks, who are associated with cold, who are associated with ice, which is a frozen form of water, and this is the quenching of water. Because he for sure ain't a lion. Now, he is...
The sacrifice is the thing, right?
He does love Ghost.
Yeah.
But does he love Ghost as much as he would Ygritte?
I don't know.
Like, if you could save Ghost or Ygritte, who does he save?
That's a thing. Like, I...
Like, that's, you're talking about a man's wife, if you're talking about the analogy to Nisa here.
Right, right. Maybe at some point Ghost and John get married. I don't know.
I mean, I get tons of theories. Someone was theorizing that could be, like, you know, if you go to fairy tale ending of John and Danny getting together and as joint conquerors and perhaps mates, that at some point John has to kill Danny. You could easily say that Danny has to kill John. I think we might even, I start to forget at this point what stuff I've actually talked about in the podcast and what stuff I didn't have time to talk about and what stuff I've read online, but I feel like I'm about to close the door on Lightbringer theories because they've all been rehashed.
And we
need to get more information. Like, something new has to happen. Either the Winds of Winter comes out, which, by the way, George R. R. Martin put on his live journal that he has some big news to discuss after a recent meeting with his editors in New York.
He's never going to release the books.
Yeah, he's got an indefinite extension. Good news, I'm off the hook. But yeah, that could be exciting.
Could be.
But until we get a new book or new episodes or another season, like, and until something else comes of Lightbringer, it's going to be hard to kind of get a Lightbringer theory on the table. So
yeah, I'm with you.
Okay, I almost forgot the corrections from the previous edition again, because, again, shotgun podcast, all that. But Broom Person started another thread, and there's a couple of small various. It seems like I had a pretty good, a much better podcast than the normal as far as getting things wrong. But Murder Bear wrote in and said, wanted to correct that Leaf is the one that told Bran that Cold Hands died long ago, not Benjen himself. Or Cold Hands, rather. I always took that as some kind of doublespeak that, yeah, it's Benjen's body, but it's not him anymore. He's just a puppet of Bloodraven. He could definitely be a red herring, but it just makes so much sense for him to be Cold Hands. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, it's weird doublespeak because he says Cold Hands died long ago. Benjen did not die long ago. The Bloodraven is not dead, so she can't be speaking to him. It's like, what? That's beyond double talk. That's just straight up lying, man. That's beyond Obi-Wan Kenobi style bullshit. Kojita Wood mentioned, I said that Arthur Dayne was dual wielding great swords. He says he was most definitely not. Even the Mountain would be hard pressed to do that. I heard many people say that he was dual wielding great swords. I also know that he was the prop guys intended him for one of those swords to be Dawn, which I've always heard described as a great sword. But to be honest, I'm kind of ignorant about medieval technology, so I don't know what separates a broadsword from a great sword. From, like, is a great sword like Ned's ice? Then fine, yeah, nobody's going to be dual wielding that. Is it like a claymore? I don't know. I think Liam Neeson could probably dual wield one of those things. I just don't know. But if I misspoke, I don't want to, you know, irritate anybody in the society for what's that, the SCA, the Society for Creative Anachronistic Combat or whatever?
I don't know.
The guys who are actually forging swords and making, I don't want them coming for me.
Yeah. Because they have swords, and you don't want that.
Yeah. John Roberts wanted to point out that the Mashable.com article that I listed for the Baratheon family tree is actually wrong, and it was a fan creation by a user on the wiki of... It's based on a fan creation by a user on the wiki of Ice and Fire that goes by the name of Eagle of Sigurd. In truth, there is no real actual Baratheon family tree that goes that far back. And I, you know, again, like, I didn't really care. I was just passing it on, so any errors were not my own, and I'm fine with Jaime not fucking being a secret Baratheon, Targaryen, or whatever the hell he was supposed to
be. Seems like everyone is.
Yeah. So apparently I got some things wrong about Ashara Dayne. It's just, Jesus Christ, I cursed the day I ever brought up her name and associated anything with her. But Edric Dayne tells Arya Stark about his aunt Ashara, who died before he was born. This is Edric, not Arya. It's Edric's aunt, not Arya's. Having committed suicide because her heart was broken, he is surprised that Arya had never heard of Ashara and that Arya's father Ned had never spoken of her. Edric tells Arya that his aunt Alaria says that Ashara and Ned fell in love at Harrenhal, which was news to me. I don't remember this, and I didn't remember that Ned and her ever being a possibility of some kind of love triangle, although now that I think of it, maybe there was a rumor that Ned's bastard was Ashara's. This is a quote from Barristan Selmy. Ashara's daughter had been stillborn, and his fair lady had thrown herself from a tower soon after, mad with grief for the child she had lost, and perhaps for the man who had dishonored her at Harrenhal as well. His conclusion is Ashara probably didn't commit suicide because Arthur Dayne died. It's more likely that, A, she gave birth to a stillborn child, and or she was in love with someone she couldn't have, perhaps Ned, now married to Catelyn Tully, or perhaps Brandon Stark, dead, or someone else. It probably had very little to do with the fact that Arthur Dayne died, besides if she was in love with Ned, and he then had to tell her not only he couldn't marry her, but that he had killed her brother, and that what caused her to be grief-struck. So, again, had some minor problems with Ashara Dayne. I'll try not to speak her name again, since she's dead, and I don't think she's going around as anybody else. Theories to the contrary. So that will be the end of our podcast. Again, get on forums.baldmove.com. If I made any mistakes, you want to tell me where I fucked up or just talk about spoiler theories or whatever, or you can email them to gameofthrones@baldmove.com. Be back to normal next week. Sunday night, we got the instant cast. Tuesday, we got the full cast. And Friday, we'll have the spoiler edition, and I'll have a lot more time to work on all of them. Thanks very much again for all your well wishes for my family. Looks like everything's going to be great. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you Sunday night. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Bye-bye.